For those who don't know about this building, did I say enough about it? You can join the Art Workers Guild, and I think these are probably all examples of art workers and their work. And there is an enormous room at the back, which has which has the sort of stenciled names of all the art workers around the room, sort of downstairs and through there. And we just decided that this is a great place to host events. So for those who don't know about it, they're very nice.
How did you find it?
I found it because somebody at CSM was giving a talk about the history of the art college, and I saw a little poster, and I passed the door, and it was closed, and it was on, I mean, there were lots of people ringing the bell tonight, but I actually couldn't get in, and I thought, God, what a great place. I'll have to try and get in sometime and use it. And then we started to get to know the people who run it. And
how long has it been going, do you know?
It's been going since just after the First World War, so it was...
Wow.
When it was a very run-down area, it was an old printing works at the back, and they bought it, and then they did it up for the
artwork. So I've actually gone past this, and I've actually gone past the building and seen Art Workers Guild and
wondered
about it.
So had I, but it's really huge at the back, and it was kind of redone after the First World War.
Is there a library, isn't there, at the back? Or there's a room for
There's a office? Huge room. Well, I only know the sort of big conference room, but they may have you know, library facilities or something. Oh, where is Tina? She's here. No, she's not.
There's a bed downstairs.
So, does the Art Workers Guild exist as an organisation?
It does exist.
Since the First World War.
Yeah, it does exist as an organisation, and it's mostly men, I have to say, but there are some women in it as well. I think we should all join. They also run something called Cultural Bloomsbury. Gosh, I feel like I'm an advocate. Wait, Tina. They run something, they're part of something called Cultural Bloomsbury. And in fact, they had a drinks event here last night, which I couldn't come to. But, I mean, they're very, very, they really want people to use the place and to get
involved.
They might have, I really don't know.
Yeah.
It sounds as if they were
artwork.
Great term.
I don't know.
Very
good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We make works of art.
Yeah, we're thinking about the artwork in your absence. And can I kick off, Tina, by asking why these three pieces are for you, the kind of relationship between them? Because it threw up so many things for me as a viewer, and I found it fascinating.
Well, one of the main reasons was that you said it was very much wanted it around performance.
Yeah.
So I looked at the first one, was that the audience were the performers. They walked to the space and so forth and things like that. And then the second one, of course, is it was a performance, and the film also became using the idea of performance and not actors or so forth. And there's performance art within the film. And the last one is that Evelyn Hagen is such a performer. And so, in a way, I felt that they moved in between the idea, in a sense, like you've got a whole group of people walking towards something who've never met. Some people knew each other, some people didn't. So they could actually get to know each other at that time of linking up to do the long walk. And then the middle one, in a way, in a sense, is that all the people who were doing the... swimming in the film. I think in the film, they weren't so much in the performances, they weren't actually synchronised swimmers, but some they were. So in a way, in a sense, they were professional people doing the performance, so rather than amateur or artists, you know, that's what they do. And the next one is the individual who we know and we meet every so often, who is a natural performer. So in a way, it's performance that really linked them all together in some way or another. And also, it was quite nice in a way having Neon Diver with only music, no sound, no voiceover. It's just about movement, colour, space, pattern making in a way, which I think is really important as well. And then with Yvonne, that's completely stripped away, and all you've got is this person talking. There's no imagery other than Yvonne. You know, and you didn't need anything because she was so articulate and wonderful at describing things that you got locked into her imagination. You could actually see, and as you hear it, you see what she's talking about. And I just thought that was wonderful.
I mean, in some ways, and you also begin to read the works against each other as a viewer, partly because you pay a lot of attention to the viewer. And I found myself, I don't know about other people, then really having watched your attention to these young women's bodies, to actually watch your attention, if you like, to Yvonne's body and her attention to herself, to her own body, the way in which she behaves with her body, her crossed legs, her behaviour with her hands, her arms, she's extremely animated, her skirt, her neck. It's very, very interesting.
It's really interesting, that, because I saw recently Jeanine Greer on television talking, followed by Catherine Deneuve, and they both did some things, older women, that younger women who are media savvy would never do. They were doing things like, or this, and it's that kind of unself-consciousness to the camera that younger groomed women would never have to do that kind of thing. You know, where you, you know, but she was fascinating. It reminded me of that Warhol interview with Diana Vreeland.
Yes, I think actually at one point, it did come across, after seeing it for a while, yes, that she has.
Which is also really fascinating. And it's quite poignant, actually, because it's when somebody's travelling back, reminiscing, and they gaze into the distance.
Yeah.
That kind of
the amazing sharpness of Yvonne Hagen's mind.
Oh, yeah, and she was, I think, 80-something. I mean, 80, over 85, I know that, you know.
Wow.
Oh, no, she was, oh, God, you know. She was very alive, actually. Mm. I think the trouble was that her mind was more alive than some of her body. She fell over a couple of times in her excitement, you know.
But it's also the spectacle, because always in the world is that pleasure of the spectacle.
Yes.
You know, they're all about spectacle.
Yes, they are. Often we used to get told off about that. Yeah, it's quite interesting when you say, but I think film is about spectacle in some way or other, you know, because it's a visual medium, you know what I mean? And so therefore, in a way that and you say, I don't know, it's very hard to explain, actually, but some people just are so good at sort of acting to camera, you know, using or forgetting the camera and just become themselves in a way. And I think that's what Yvonne's done. She was very aware where the camera was, always, you know. But on the other hand, she would forget it in a way that she was speaking to the camera, if you understand what I'm saying.
I thought she was also very aware of placing certain things in front of the viewer. The sheets that she refers to, for instance, particularly. Setting things in the public record, actually, as well. And they're things that are immensely, well, some of them are ephemeral, some of them are material, but they're all extremely animated as you visualise them through her narrative. And that's one of the other things that you seem to have done there that links, you know, because you have the voices at in the first film that you chose to show, which are much more traditionally kind of oral historical voices. They're much more... What's the word? They're not quite amorphous, but they kind of move around and outwards. And then at the end, coming back to Nina Hagen's voice, she's got this immense kind of intellectual training, really. You become very aware of attention. So you're paying all this visual attention all the way through these films. Then you attend to her attention. And I remember when you told me about showing the film and said that you'd had it for a while.
Yes.
Could you say something about you'd had it for a while, then you decided to put it into black and white, and then you decided...
Yeah.
Okay, you would show it.
Yeah, I do that, actually. I film quite a lot. And sometimes what I do, I suppose in this book, say it's like you sit on it. And because sometimes I don't always fully appreciate what I've done, or I like to leave it. I like to get a distance on it so that I'm not sort of, I'm more intellectually involved with it rather than emotionally involved. And I think with someone like... Yvonne, who I know incredibly well, it's very difficult. To get that sort of detachment in a way that I can just take part of a conversation that I've had with her, in essence, and work with it as a film, so that she becomes the actress, and so it's divorced from me in a way. I become a director, you know. And so, but I could only do that after a period of time where I've sort of got used to the material in a way. So that sort of emotional side has disappeared.
Mm. And then what about the decision to make it into black and white?
The reason to do that actually was quite interesting actually, because in a way, when it was colour, it was too much of now. Mm. So taking it into black and white is again very old-fashioned cliche really of filmmaking is memory, you know. And I was quite aware of that in a way, you know, like with that wonderful old movies, you know, and things like that. And it's colour, and then you want to do something in the past, and you go into the past, and it always comes up black and white. And it was a similar way to that, actually using in a way that sort of like filmic technique. Mm. Yeah, so that's why I did that, and I think it really works in a way because it becomes very much more sculptural. Because you're not aware about colour, what her clothes are, or whatever, you know what I mean? She's more like a sort of extraordinary animated sculpture, really.
Mm. But I also wonder whether there's something else going on, and certainly other people jump in, but where do you think it's true that you can do less at certain points in your career, as your career moves on? So you make this very small intervention. All you do with that print is to frame it and put it into black and white, but it reads against a great deal of your other work, so that your attention to the female body, the interest in feminism, the work with the spectator is present. I mean, you also showed it to us tonight in a very particular sequence, and so we were even more aware of it. But is that something that was also there in curating that experience, or placing that particular film now in your...
Well, I suppose it was in a way. I was taking the idea, very much in a way, a sense of what was wonderful about Yvonne, it's this old woman. No one likes to look at an old woman, do you?
But she is.
Do you know what I mean? And so therefore, in a way, like taking someone who is like in her 80s, talking alive and coherent, interesting, that you're compelled to look at, which I think is wonderful. It really is. And it's very unusual. How many films do we see with old women in? Mm. Not many. We see wise old men, but we don't see any wise women. So therefore, in a way, that was in my mind as well, that she was quite an extraordinary person, that she really, that she could hold her own. And that's another thing about, you know, especially if you make films and things like that in a way, is that how people actually relate. She relates to the camera, and that's always very nice, actually, for a filmmaker, isn't it? You know, that they actually act up to the camera, you know, and she loves the camera, she loves it. So that makes it very easy for me as a director, because she does all the work. I just point the camera, and off she goes.
But also, she was taught, it was in black and white, but she was talking so much about colour. Mm-hmm. And the way she used her words and her memory is that you could almost see those colours.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's a very good point, Felicity, actually. And especially when I think this might be one of the other reasons. You know, when you're editing, sometimes you forget and it's like then you're working on something and you have to close up. But the point is that she, it's about Eve Klein, it's about blue.
Mm-hmm.
So therefore, in a way, she's black and white and she's talking about blue. But if she was in colour, that would also muddy the
blue. No, that's why I said it, because it seemed to enhance it.
I hadn't thought of that.
You kind of visualise the colour, and when she was talking about the gas and the flame and the gold, the fact that it was in black and white enhanced your own memory image, if you like, of those colours.
Yeah.
It's fascinating, because it's very interesting when something becomes very much more than itself. And the sequence that you showed, the last film, Yvonne Hagen's monologue, became for me so much more than it was very simple. But so you're reading it against Neon Diver, which in itself has a blue tinge, first of all, and you know, and there's the blue in the swimming pool. But so you choose to shoot her, you choose to turn it into black and white. She talks about blue, and she's also talking about the ineffable. The work that came to my mind was David Hammond's Blue Light. Does anybody know that? Where David Hammond's... it's a sort of comment on blackness and blueness and being blue and blue and the blues, which is basically an empty gallery in New York which is black, which is dark, and you get a blue light when you go in. It's a tiny blue torch, and that's the work. You just go and find the space. And Glenn Ligon wrote a brilliant article about it in Art Forum a few years ago. But immediately it made me think about what it is to tell a story, what that narrative is, what this enormous imaginative world that comes out of the voice that you're filming at the same time. So it's like you're also filming the voice. Mm. And the voice itself is this big imaginative world. That was fascinating.
And I found that she was obviously drawing upon images that were in her mind. And as you mentioned, because of the selection of films that we saw, I was seeing the images from Neon Diver while she was talking. And this relates, I guess, to the spectacle as a general theme in your work. And when she says the line of flames all kind of coming up together, and then I see, you know, and then Eve Klein in this white box, basically, and people coming in and out, it made me think of, I can see these circles of swimmers, and it all feeling very kind of choreographed, I guess, the way that she was describing a history, which obviously didn't have to go the way that it went, but in her mind it was synchronized in a way. Of course it went, this happened, and then this happened, and then this happened. In a very, like a dance.
Oh, that's interesting. I think it's also because she is a writer, and you wrote about art, looked at art, knew lots of artists. So she was very afraid with the language and the visual language. So when she speaks, actually, I think she speaks also in a way, she doesn't speak just in words, but she speaks in pictures, in images. And I think that's why. I think that's why she's so quite interesting. And that's why one is so drawn to what she's saying. Because, as I say, you didn't need to know. You didn't need any pictures of his art. She described them so well. You felt you'd seen them, you know, that you knew them. You know what I mean? And that's quite extraordinary in a way. And she's got that. I mean, she must also be, in a way, she must be. She's also, I mean, has a sort of, like, she's like an actor in a way as well, isn't she? And that she can go beyond herself in a way and describe things in a particular way and become that. You know? I think that's what's quite interesting. And as I say, especially for a filmmaker, she's great because she just loves the camera. She doesn't shy away from it. She actually was talking to the camera. She was very aware where the camera was, you know, down there, you know what I mean? It wasn't, and it was very purposely, you know, the camera just plonked down. It wasn't meant to be, you know what I mean, the usual way. But she, in a way, understood exactly where that camera was and when to speak to it and not to as well. And I found that quite fascinating, actually, you know, that she understood it, you know.
Can I ask you did you give her any sort of, I'm thinking about direction, being a director, did you give her any specific instructions about what to do or what not to do, or were you going to speak, or was it just going to be her?
No, actually, to be quite honest, I never meant to make a film at all. I bought a new camera and said to her, oh, I've got this new little digital camera, stuck it down on the floor, you know, basically. And I might have sort of switched it on because I was just trying it out. It's totally a new camera. And I was telling her about it, you know. And then we started having this conversation. And actually, I'm to the side, she's looking at me at the side. And her daughter actually is in front of her, Nina, who's also there. So she's talking to both of them.
That's who she's looking at. Like yes,
so she's,
left,
and
yeah.
That's also quite good because it's giving her two ways of actually looking, you know, towards me, which I'm quite close to the camera, and to her daughter, which is in front of her. So that gives her another sort of area of action to respond to. So I don't know if she was responding that much to the camera, other than responding to both her daughter and myself, you know what I mean?
It's really strange, something keeps coming back to me, which was it Roland Barthes talked about the punctum in a picture? He was talking about still photography, the point which actually emotionally connects you to the subject. And the bizarre thing is, I found that I kept trying not to think about it, but it was when this person just walks across the back, completely ignores.
Oh, yes, yes, yes.
And, yeah. And it's almost like, because you've created this very sort of particular framing, although it might be arbitrary. I don't think anything is truly arbitrary, really. and then suddenly this formalism is kind of undercut.
Yeah,
yeah. Just wanders across the pair of jeans. And it's almost like that suddenly makes the rest of the film more focused.
Yeah.
It's almost like now you really start to, you know, it's almost like, well, you're just going to be looking at this person for 20 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
What's happening at the peripheries? And what's happening at the peripheries is one's own imagination about what she's saying.
Mm-hmm.
That
yeah,
begins to
yeah,
be the person
right.
moving past the back
yeah.
of the field.
Yeah, that's when her son gets up and walks out. as I say, it wasn't. It was never meant to be a film at all. And I was just looking through my, you know, rushes and stuff, and I came across it and thought, oh, this is really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And by that time, actually, she'd been dead about 2 years.
Mm.
And in some ways it was so wonderful to sort of like rediscover her. I think that's what I'm saying. And I thought, oh, maybe I'll have a look at this. So I put it onto my computer and looked at it. And then I realised, I thought, oh God, this makes a really interesting film. And also, and I mustn't edit it.
Mm.
Because the whole thing is about her talking and shifting and moving is that there's a continuum.
There seemed to be one edit. Wasn't there one stop?
I don't know, I can't remember now.
So yeah.
That's
where she's talking about the gas and she's describing it and then her hands.
Oh, maybe there is actually.
Oh, the museum.
Yeah, you're right,
the
there is one.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But
other than that, no, I think that was just something.
It's really interesting, though, that you found it all after she died, because I wonder why you made it when you made it. But when you said that, it's exactly like the Buck, when he says the photograph is an encounter with death.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Exactly that. And because, of course, she's so alive, actually.
Well,
she
yes,
is so visually enticing in her 80s,
yeah.
as you said, which is in itself sort of interesting and attractive. So it's sort of I guess there's that kind of dialectic between... You know, the encounter with death and the kind of vividness.
Yes, but also I think it's a way that was such a joy to actually see her.
Mm.
So
yeah.
lovely, so articulate and energetic. You know what I mean? I just thought, oh God, this is so great. You know what I mean? And yes, she was, and she's dead, but she's not dead.
That's what Bart says. Well, he says it the other way around, actually, about children.
That thing you said about, you know, we don't like to look at old people, you know, and I was thinking... Mm. Apart from our mothers or fathers, you know,
yeah.
that we don't even see them as old, we just see them as our parents. And I think in a way, old people have been constructed in the same way as, say, Africa has been constructed. So you think of Africa, immediately people think of swollen belly, starving child, who's about to die in 3 days' time.
Mm.
And when you think of old people, certainly in Western media, you immediately think of rest homes, people sat around the edge in chairs looking at the telly like this. So it's fantastic to have images of old people that actually tell the real story. Actually, most old people are incredibly active, and they're older rather than old, in fact.
Yeah, I think that's a really lovely way of putting it. They're older.
Most old people I know, keep going till they drop, basically. You know? And the proportion of people you get who just stop or wind down is very small compared to the proportion of people who just carry on, regardless.
Mm.
You know? But those images aren't shown, so it's to do with the image reservoir that we're given or fed constantly.
Yeah.
And it's great to be able to change that image reservoir and say, well, actually, old people are, you know, intellectually extraordinary compared to us because they've had another 40 or 50 years, you know, thinking and doing things.
Yeah.
And are quite sort of, quite camera savvy in a different way, I think. She's quite sort of, she did actually know how, I wondered if she must have done lots of interviews in her life. Because she seemed to know how to handle the camera,
the
angle.
Very
it's my good side.
Mm. I mean, she lived in Paris and she lived in London, and I think she says through the war she was, you know, she was art reviewer and a journalist, and she had some amazing, wonderful women friends in Chelsea. You know, and his amazing mansion blocks in Chelsea as well. And they were fantastic. Going out to dinner with them was sort of extraordinary fun, you know, and they were so alive, you know.
How did you know her?
Hmm?
How did you come to know her?
I was just trying to think, actually. I think through a friend of mine when I was doing my paintings.
Mm.
And Kit Callahan, who's a painter, a friend of mine. And Kit said, oh, you come and see Yvonne because she's... wants to do all the painting. She's doing my paintings, and I think she'll like yours, and so I'm doing painting. And that's how I met her, so I went up to see her. And she lived just off the Edgware Road. And she was also, at that time, think she was just getting, with another artist that she lived with, who was a sculptor and played music. And so she was always in the art world, actually, for quite a long, for a very long time, you know. So she was to be in London for certain things, then she'd be in Paris, and then she'd be back to New York. I mean, she was constantly active, you know, and knew lots of people. And also, she's one of those sort of people who are incredibly charming and loved giving cocktail parties. So we all love that. And so, I don't know, she was just one of those sort of wonderful people to know, you know what I mean? I think we all missed her, when she died. But then she stopped coming to London quite a lot, but I used to go and stay with her in Long Island. But she was always so great in a way, because her daughter, you know, used to be telling her off and would be going off to have sort of cocktails at, you know, 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and her mother driving the car.
Has her daughter seen the film?
No, she hasn't. I haven't managed to get hold of her, you know, actually. And she's got 2 other children. And so I think the children, as they do, you know, like become quite sort of, you know how you do your parents, you know, especially your parents are gregarious, it's usually the children are much quieter, you know what I mean? And most probably find mother a little bit embarrassing. You know?
So how did Eve Klein come into that?
Well, she knew Eve Klein.
But she just, you're describing a fairly kind of random scenario as far as I understand it, and did she just start talking about Eve Klein?
Yeah, I think she did, yeah.
So you ended up getting this one.
Yeah, because I've got a long tape, yeah. Just put the tape down, and she I don't know why, she suddenly went off on a, you know, started just talking about Eve Klein, you know. And the camera just rolled on, and just like that. I mean, I've no idea. It was, none of it was staged at all. You know, there I was, staying with her, it's summertime, wasn't thinking of making any art at all. I just bought this new camera and plopped it down, you know. And I said to her, I've got this new camera, and she obviously found this quite interesting. And she just acted up to it.
But I think I want to pick up Richard's point about kind of almost no accidents, because one of the things I think I've become very interested in, partly in writing about Susan's work, I sort of thought about the way in which the camera acts as a kind of prosthetic, if you like, or it becomes you, or it's never just a thing, it's placed there, but you have to place it there a huge number of times, or, I mean, not necessarily in that one situation, but it has to be something which is repetitive, or done every day, or more or less something, it's part of your habit.
No, I don't think that's quite true for me,
isn't
actually.
It? Because you were saying you make lots and lots of...
Yeah, I do, but actually also I put my camera away sometimes and don't look at it.
No, I'm sure. I just kind of wonder if that's worth...
There's something really interesting about the camera, which is a completely different thing that I was really interested in. Because it's how complex Neon Diver as a film is. That it was became a film. And it's that moment where we see the cameraman under the water. Filming the camera and the swimmer. And that whole thing of how it actually becomes somehow more surreal at that moment. Which is something that echoes through the film as a kind of surreal quality of women becoming animal. But it was really significant that there was a camera watching a male cameraman filming the swimmers. And he was really, it was like a prosthetic device. It was just some very practical technical questions, like how many cameras did you have filming?
I think we had 3. I think we had one was the Super 8, one was the underwater camera that he had. Oh, and then we had, I think actually one of it was also some shot. It was on 35 on the diving board, it was a 3-day shoot
seemed really quite complex once I'd realised there were cameras.
It was very complex actually. And he was hired actually to do all the underwater stuff actually. It was a friend of mine actually, and also didn't charge very much.
Because that was the
and then there was, and then we, I think it was, who was it? It was Catherine and myself. We shot, had a Super 8, and then we'd just run round. And often I do that when filming and document, you know, the filming. So, be quite honest, I don't know if we even thought those shots would go into the film until the editing process. Because in a way, when you're making a film like that, and it's, you know, it's art scale, so it's a very strict budget, and it's got its this, and it's got its that, you know, everything is like framed the same. And so, in a way, sometimes what it is too, I've always thought that, okay, you shoot it in a particular way, you know, and you have a camera person, you shoot this, you shoot that, you move it, you shift it, and so forth, you know. And then you have another camera, either a little 16mm or Super 8, and then you film other things. And then those other things, in a way, become a bit like the sort of landscape of the film. And you don't know where they're going to be until you start editing. And then suddenly they fit in. So that wasn't actually storyboarded, you know, things like that. They're also, because when you're making a film like for money for the Arts Council and stuff, everything has to be storyboarded. It has to be this and it has to be that, you know, and documented. So in a way, that's why when making those sort of films, I think the most interesting thing is to have a couple of other cameras running around just filming. Mm. And often, some of those off limits, in a way, should we say, are sometimes the most interesting shots. But also it makes it very difficult, in a way. Funny enough, I had a conversation with David Curtis a long time ago, where I cut on the driving board, and he refused to agree with me on it, between a 35mm shot and a 16mm. He said, Tina, you could never edit those two shots together. Mm. I said, I have, it's there, I can pinpoint it for you. But he was like, you know what I mean? Because people have very, very fixed ideas, in a way, of how you make a film. Yeah. But when an artist actually starts to make a film, they sort of like pull it to bits, you know. They say, oh, I want this, I want that. And so a lot of work is also done with the editing, you know, like the superimpositions and things like that. Because the limitations on time, you know, that you've got for filming is very limited. So you have to have extra footage and things like that, you know, that you can do.
I wanted to ask a question that was sort of related to that, which is I was wondering what you think of as the relationship between documentation of your performances and your performances, if we can say that they have some other value or existence. Because I noticed in the first one that this was...
As a documentation.
Is the first one documentation or not? Or do you think of it in a different way? And how do you think about documentation as opposed to the performance itself? Because, and then in the second one, of course, this is a film that comes out of a performance.
Well, Neil and Dive is definitely a film. Mm. It's not documentation whatsoever. None of it's documentation. The first one is actually, I mean, was a very long walk, isn't it? And quite a long piece. And it's been shot over a period of time, and then you just cut it down to as a document for people to see.
But I saw it as a film.
Mm.
It related to me to some kind of interesting kind of amateur films about science fiction.
Well, I suppose in a way that's quite interesting in a way that it was documented at the time, you know, maybe
it,
a game with 16. Yeah.
We've gotten used to seeing. On
yeah, and then when it came to editing, it we just edited it down like a film. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
I mean, I suppose in a way, does it really matter if it's documentation or it's this or that? I see it very much is it's film footage.
I found it interesting because I was probably one of the people that could have been in your...
Filmed, yeah.
Yeah, exactly, because I went there.
I was there.
I was there too, but I wasn't behind the camera. I was possibly in front of the camera. But it was very... I don't think I'd seen it before.
It kind of
reminded me of being there, but it was actually something else. It wasn't just documentation, is what I'm trying to say. You had suddenly, from the documentation, possibly if it had been longer, maybe the fact that it was documentation might have been more obvious. But it was short, and I thought it was very self-contained, and I didn't think of it as documentation. Which, as I said, had it been longer, I might have.
Thought of it as a film at the time, you know.
Yeah, I thought of it as a film, not as documentation.
Well, I think at the time...
I think it's quite an interesting question, though.
Yeah.
When documentation becomes the art, because there's a lot of people that the documentation is the art.
Yeah.
But I know enough people who particularly working in performance and film and performance, who won't allow documentation because you're either there and you witness it, or you're not and you're never going to get the chance to experience it otherwise.
Yeah,
I mean, I'm
right.
thinking of Annabelle Nicholson, for example. But I think there's something in between because, as I said, I was there at the time, but there was something quite different that was on the screen this evening.
Right. Well, yes, because it was a very long walk, and I think we'd only shot.
It was a long walk.
Only shot right at the end, actually, where the camera was.
Yeah.
And I think someone actually shone a torch into people's faces because it was so dark to pick it up. So that gives it another thing. So in a way, it was making a film, I suppose, in a sense. I said it was documentation because we were documenting this performance. I mean, that's the whole thing about what's always so interesting about performance. Performance sort of shifts all the time, doesn't it? Isn't it? There's no definition really in that way because if you're, you know, that was meant to be a performance, which it was, and then it was being filmed, and then it becomes a film. But actually, people who were there, they were in a performance, like walking, walking, until they get to certain points, you know, and you're listening to the sound, you know what I mean? And there, when you're watching this sort of.
And experiencing the kind of 3D of the laser in the forest,
yeah,
and the projections. no, I think it was possibly down to the editing, the way you edited it all together. It became, for me, more than just documentation.
Yeah, most probably did, because I most probably like editing, making film. So I most probably make a film out of material that I've got. So I made a little movie, I suppose, yeah.
But presumably the soundtrack, the things that people were saying played a big role in that. Shifting it from a documentation of, I don't know.
No,
I presume they weren't all standing around saying those things when you were doing your walk through the forest.
Yeah.
But you were hearing that sound.
Oh,
yeah.
Well,
I'm
saying
I wasn't
only
there, so I don't know.
It's quite interesting. The actual soundtrack
it's a complicated
was only
performance.
was only, the soundtrack was only up to where you see the neon.
Okay,
right?
That was what you
and
did,
so what you do
did.
Is like this is when I say that the audience people came out like the performance really. There you gave them the earphones and the tape, whatever, and they could hear what was being spoken by these people as they walked along. So they were getting the idea of the forest and the people who lived there and so forth, you know. So, but when it got up to sort of the actual forest itself, you know, then the neon says, I'm buying a Lego. So it was like opening this gate, you know, into this whole other world with the laser and the strange sort of ponies moving. And we had such a lot of problems with the ponies because they said you have to have the right pony and the legs. Is this length and that length? Anyway, the whole thing got so ridiculous. In the end, we decided to draw the ponies, put them into negative and things like that, you know. And so the whole thing was, and had those on and had the ponies on a big screen. So when you entered, actually, especially as it was in the distance and you couldn't see the edge of the screen, you could only actually see the movement of the ponies. You really felt that they were running through the trees. Which was really nice. And then the laser was coming out, and not only that, the laser was so large and the beam that it was going way over, you know what I mean? So it is a bit like science fiction, actually, you know, the end of film, Close Encounters, you know, things like that. Yeah. And so you got that, actually. But basically, all you were in the New Forest.
But also, I seem to remember the sound was kind of. Via radio.
Oh, yeah, the sound was a sort of.
So you could go in places where there was no transmission, and you had to kind of come back to kind of hear the end of the story.
You had to keep to the path, otherwise you couldn't get the transmission.
Yeah.
And also you had, and there was also on the soundtrack. I think there was some sort of wind as well going on under the words and things like that. Yeah, but yeah, if you went off the track, that's what you can't do that, you know, if you want to know what's going on.
Yeah.
So we controlled you by. By the earphones. Okay, that piece actually, it took ages to make. It was very, very difficult. But I think it's one of my best. But
fantastic.
I think it nearly killed me, actually.
We all went down on a coach together. from outside
the
table.
From the inevitable here.
That's right.
Should we close there and go and see if people would like to come with us? Unless there are other things people
just
want to see.
Something that reminds me about, you saying it was
that nearly killed you is that element of risk that used to go on years ago, mm. where you were stringing things together with, you know, it was all like, whoa.
Yeah.
And I don't know whether there's always that element of risk so much around anymore. Do you think so?
I don't think so. I think everything's so very well planned, and also there's so many rules and regulations.
Yeah.
Actually, you know, it's got very quite difficult to do this.
Yeah. Yeah. I think so. So that's
yeah,
right.
Yeah.
So that
do that because you mustn't do it like that, and you mustn't touch that, and you mustn't do this, and you know, yeah, no. But you usually do get around
juggling.
Yeah, juggle.
Because
but also the technology is more advanced now. I mean, like the radio sound was so crude.
That's right, which is lovely.
Exactly, but I think if you were doing it now, it would be much more precise, and you wouldn't find yourself wandering off the...
No. No, they most probably have to have sort of like, you know, people telling you to keep in line, isn't
it? But it's as well, isn't it, now, that requires you to sort of script your life for the next 3 years, you know, in order to get some money just to do what you want to do with it,
And yet there are other people who, because there are always, thinking about what we were saying about the kind of field of vision, there are 14-year-olds filming themselves in the dark, jumping off buildings,
exactly.
doing this.
Yeah, yes.
Fairly risky. I mean, doing similar kinds of things, sticking it up on YouTube.
Yeah.
Can I just ask you, what do you think is that essential difference between a filmmaker and an artist using the medium of film to make their work?
Oh, big one.
I think artists actually break the rules more often, actually. Also, you usually have less money.
Always have less money.
The filmmakers. And so therefore, it always has to be, in a way, I mean, the films are usually sort of edited, usually, you know, by the artist, the director.
It's incredibly expensive, the whole editing.
Yeah.
But I mean, I was thinking of like someone like Steve McQueen, who's shifted from being an artist who uses the film medium and is now seen as a filmmaker because of one film, Hunger. You know, and do you see at some point, say you had the resource, would you ever want to shift and reframe yourself as a filmmaker rather than an artist using the medium of film?
I don't think so, actually, because I've always seen myself as an artist, actually, that works within the area of performance and light. And film and moving image in a way. So I've never really seen myself, actually, because I've worked on other people's films as well, and been, actually, when I was quite young, actually, I saw it my money by being a film extra, is that I think it's too, doing that is too rigid for me in a way.
I think it's a very difficult thing to do with nomenclature. I mean, I can remember in the 70s, and this was something that was largely put together by Dave Curtis, amongst others, who was working at the Arts Council, that he classified certain people as filmmakers, no matter that they'd come through art school and were artist filmmakers, whether it was Malcolm McGrice or William Rayburn or Liz Rhodes. He felt they were full-time filmmakers and were dedicating themselves to films. And that became avant-garde film. And then there were certain artists. Susan Hiller was one, Tina was one, Ian Brakewell was one, who were artists, who occasionally made films. And Dave actually poured scorn on those people. I mean, he's eaten his words since. And now, in a way, the people that you're talking about, the Steve McQueens, are very much like the people back in the 70s and the 80s who were artists who occasionally made films, but that didn't mean to say the films they made weren't professionally made films. They just wanted to work with film. Some people did their own camera work. Some people, like Steve McQueen, got other people to come in and do their camera work.
But there's
a whole shift, and that the whole term avant-garde film, avant-garde filmmakers, has like gone, it's disappeared. Everyone now is an artist filmmaker. And so the difference between an artist filmmaker and a filmmaker, I find I have to go back and kind of remember those things that we grew out of in the 70s. Frankly, the art world and the film world didn't want to know about anyone though I wasn't working strictly within an industry. And if you were an artist who happened to work in film, the art world didn't want to know. I mean, John Nathan was making films in the 60s. His gallery didn't want to know until he died. And suddenly his films were possibly interesting. It's a kind of interesting thing, but I think it's not quite as simplistic as you were saying.
Well, I thought it was interesting that show that Parasol Unit did, where they got, it's based around the notion of animation.
Yeah.
And they had, like, basically half of it was by people considered professional animators in the world of professional animation, and half were artists who'd used animation in their work.
Mm.
And, you know, that once you got over the thing about technique, in that more of the artists would use what you would call rough and ready or, inverted commas, avant-garde techniques, and more of the animators would use more conventional techniques. But obviously a lot of the artists were fascinated by quite sort of high-end technology as well, and, you know, could use that. And, yeah, if you can't do it yourself, why not ask someone else to do it, as long as the idea becomes manifest. So I think, you know, I think it's almost a parallel thing between film and animation. It's always been a bit of a bone of contention. But you do often get, you know, a lot of people drift between the two. And I don't think those sort of demarcations need to be too rigid, really.
Can I just correct you there? It's a Parasol Unit. The people, there was nobody there who was a really commercial animator. It was fine art animators or artists using animation. There was no commercial animators involved in that show at all.
Right, when you say commercial?
I mean commercial animators that might be working on pop videos, TV idents, that sort of arena. It was more avant-garde animators in the kind of fine art animation, which is different from
but
commercial animation.
Sort of
see, I would quarrel with that, again, going back to
that's
the 70s.
Not my category, but that's the way
but
the
I
industry
knew a lot
would
of people
itself.
That made their money in commercials as animators and chose to, Paul Vester was one of them, Jeff Dunbar, you know, they're people that were making their money. You know, the whole thing that's set up by, I was going to say Horace and Batchelor, somebody in Batchelor.
Hallis
and Batchelor. And then they were able to apply to the Arts Council and get money to work on their own projects. So in the same way that people like John Mabry, Derek Jarman, whoever, made their money from pop promos because that's the easy money, but they were still working on their own projects.
Well, Paul Vester's a typical example. He had a day job that made him money, and then he had his own practice.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know what's happening now, but I certainly knew all those people back then. That it wasn't as clearly defined as that. Maybe it's more clearly defined now.
It's a very, very interesting area altogether, actually. It's very interesting what the kinds of things that come up as soon as we begin to do that. And I introduced Tina by, in a sense, I still stick by that as being an artist whose work is perhaps best defined through approach rather than medium, which would be, I suppose, one of the things we could really... we are already talking about, and I think what you've shown tonight has certainly shown that in fascinating ways that we could probably all go on and talk about all night. But could we break there and then continue informally? Because I'd very much like to thank Tina. I loved seeing all those films. They're beautifully placed together, set up a wonderful discussion, and thank you very, very much indeed. And thank you everybody for coming.